Good afternoon and happy beautiful Sunday to you all. It is our pleasure to host another awesome Colorado Book Award finalist meeting here at BookBar. Most of you know what's going on this afternoon, but there might be a few of you over here in the back that just happened upon BookBar this afternoon. We're hosting the Colorado Book Award finalist meeting today for the young adult and juvenile literature. It is our total pleasure to do this. I see here in the room a few authors who have read here before at BookBar, and a couple that we haven't. I see here in the room kids who participate in Bookworm, which is our BookBar teen advisory program. They read for the shop, and they recommend titles, and they're really, part of the heart of what we do here at BookBar, because we really believe that as a bookstore, we should be more than just a place that, you know, does sales transactions with books, but is really a place where we can all gather around literacy, and especially when that centers around what authors are doing for children's literacy, for the young adults here. So we just so appreciate doing this. We're so happy to see you all here. Just to call attention to this situation over here on this top bookshelf, we do have some pizza bites and fruit going on, so feel free to help yourself to that, provided by the Colorado Book Awards. So without any further ado, I would want to introduce Beth Mayer. She has been just the master of coordination with all of these meetings, and she is going to introduce our amazing authors this afternoon. So please give it up for Beth. Good afternoon.
I'm not sure if this is right.
Can you guys all hear me just fine? So as Abby mentioned, I am the program coordinator for the Colorado Book Awards. And we would actually really like to thank the Book Bar and Abby and Nicole and Tommy and Allie and everybody here for providing us with this great space and for helping us make this happen. And I also want to give a little shout out to my Colorado community staff members. We've got Marnie and Brenda here tonight, or this afternoon, to help out and have been helping out as a team, you know, definitely a team effort to get this rolling. So this is our third finalist meeting of the year, and we're so happy to have you all here with us, and our juvenile literature and young adult literature are finalists. And for those of you who are taking pictures, I'm going to upload them to social media sites. We're using the hashtag CBA2022. I appreciate this opportunity to introduce you to five talented authors whose books have been named by an army of volunteer judges and selectors as finalists for the Colorado Book Awards in these categories. But before we get started, I just want to bring your attention to the fact that Colorado Book Awards and the other programs that we offer through Colorado Communities and Center for the Book are made possible in part by funding from the National Endowment of the Humanities. So if you like coming to these kinds of events and enjoy humanities and literature programming, consider contacting your representatives and letting them know that you support national funding for the National Endowment for Humanities. But that's enough of that. So juvenile literature will start, followed by young adult literature. There are copies of, I think, most of the finalist books here available for purchase tonight. And if there's one that's not here that you would like, just let us know. So we'll hope that you'll join us afterwards for book signing and also to enjoy more great snacks and drinks. Bar. And for our under 21 set, we have, I know BookBar is offering $3 chili tempers for kids. So you might want to have one of those. And then after each author reads, there'll be a Q&A, and then we'll have another chance for questions at the end. So our first reader tonight is Nancy Beau Flood from Soldier Sister Fly Home. Flood was a research scientist and studied brain development at the University of Minnesota and the University of London before writing books for children. She has a special interest in legends and folklore. Her titles include Warriors and Crackfire and Cowboy Up, Ride the Navajo Rodeo. She lives in Redwood Springs. 13-year-old Tess is having a hard enough time understanding what it means to be part white and part Navajo, but now she's coping with her sister Gabby's announcement that she's going to live and fight in the Iraq War. Gabby's decision comes just weeks after the news that Lori
Piestewa.
Piestewa, a member of their community, is the first Native American woman in U.S. history to die in combat, adding to Tess's stress and emotions. While Gabby is away, Tess reluctantly cares for her sister's semi-wild stallion, Blue, who will teach Tess how to deal with tragic loss and guide her own journey of self-discovery. Thank you for that wonderful introduction, and thank you everyone who's here, and especially the Colorado Humanities. And yes, right to your call, right to your congressional people. This is better, right?
Thank you very much.
Sorry about this.
Sorry. Is it falling down a lot right now?
Yeah. A good time to breathe. A little meditation. Thank you for the book bar. This is an amazing bookstore. We need you on the Western Slope. What I want to do is read the prologue to Soldier's Sister's Flight Home, and then I'll give you a little bit of the background of the story behind the story. So, everyone can hear me, right?
Yes.
Good. Raven's Lament. The last time I shot a rifle, I was 10. Dad picked me up after school and we headed to the rifle range just outside of Flagstaff. We drove along Route 89, the four-lane highway that runs down the long slope of the San Francisco Peaks, like a frozen gray river, straight into the hot, dry belly of the desert. The Navajo Nation, my home. I liked being at the range with my dad. I liked the kick of the rifle, the way the explosion vibrated through me and shook the sky. The burning smells were raw and real. I had a steady hand, a sharp eye. I liked it all. Gabby, my older sister by 6 years, never came with us to the rifle range. Gabby hated guns. My sister looked Navajo, like a woman warrior with gorgeous long hair. I looked white. Some kids at school didn't believe we were sisters and said I was lying about being Navajo. But we were both tall, with champion fast running legs. No one else was at the rifle range that day, just Dad and me, and one big old raven. He always showed up. Walk! He sat hunched over on top of a light pole, head cocked and watched. Reminded me of Gabby, watching, thinking, and then speaking her mind. A shiny new pickup drove in. Stirred up a whirl of dust and stopped next to us. The front door opened, and a big white guy hauled himself out of the truck, lifted up his rifle, stood and stared. Made me nervous. Bonk! That raven didn't like him either. I took careful aim at the farthest target, pulled the trigger, and shot a bullseye. That ain't real shooting. But maybe not so bad for a girl. The man held up his rifle. He glanced at the target, but then he stared at that big old bird. The raven stared back. I should have shouted, waved my arms. I didn't do anything. I didn't even move. One shot, bang. A cloud of red dust puffed up beneath the pole. Black iridescent feathers lay in a heap. The raven's eyes still open, staring, surprised. I didn't even move. The man walked over and kicked it, dumb bird, not even good for eating. I swore right then that I'd never shoot a rifle again. That was 3 years ago. Now my sister is the one carrying a rifle. I was
teaching at the time at the Navajo College, Diné College, at Tube City on the Navajo Nation. And one afternoon when I arrived, I first needed to get some groceries, so I stopped at the one grocery store, Bosch's. And there at the front of the grocery store were set up card tables that had been set up and covered with white tablecloths. And on the tablecloths were candles and a picture of Lori Piestewa. The inscription was, "I would light candles to show Lori the way home." It had just been announced that Lori, a young woman who had recently graduated from Tuba City High School, was missing in action in Iraq. It was several days later that it was announced that, in fact, she had been captured and she died. She had died defending her fellow women warriors. She was a sharpshooter. She was an outstanding student, an outstanding athlete. She had two little children. I've never seen such a community response as I did during the next couple of weeks. I attended the ceremony that was held by the Hopi, the Mexican-American community, the Navajo community, the Anglo. People came from all over both reservations to attend. And I can never forget the sound of the huge, big kettle drums beating, bum bum, bum bum, the sound of a heartbeat. At that memorial, Lori's mother and father stood in the center of the, we saw that the Tuba City High School gym, they stood in the center. And with them were Lori's two little children, those 3 and 4 years of age at the time. We all rose at one time, and in a single file, we walked around the gym around them. And as we came to the two Lori's parents, said respects. They were wrapped in a purple blanket in honor of the fallen warrior. Well, I had promised myself I was not going to set a novel on the Navajo Nation, but I couldn't get that experience out of my soul. So I started writing, thinking, "Well, I'll do a short story." And from that has come "Soldier Sister Fly Home." It is dedicated to Lori and to all our young people that have that are defending our country. It is set on the Navajo Nation, and I feel very blessed that the PSOS have been very pleased with the book, and we've had a wonderful community celebration. Tuba City Library had the first community all read ever. They chose Soldier Sister, and people came from all over
Next, J.G. Kemp will read from Mary Andromeda and the Amazing Eye. Before beginning the Journals of Evergreen Isle series, author J.G. taught high school Earth and Space Science, Biology, and Physics, and earned degrees in both visual and performing arts and educational curriculum and instruction from the University of Colorado. He lives in Colorado Springs. Like the mythical princess Andromeda, who was changed to a rock and left to be devoured by a terrible sea monster, 11-year-old Mary Andromeda is powerless, held captive in her full uncle's mansion since her mother left her 6 years ago. But when an unexpected gift and a sudden turn of events brings her to Evergreen Isle, in the seriously abandoned island of science, she begins to learn the truth about her mother's departure, the plans of a secret society, and her own place in a family of astronomers. Author and science educator J.G. Kemp reads the wonder of astronomy, technology, and science history into this fast-paced adventure mystery set in the near future.
Thank you for that introduction. Unfortunately, I don't have copies available for purchase today. I'm a new independent author and kind of trying to figure out the book thing. And I'm so honored that the Colorado Book Awards has chosen me as a finalist. I've taught high school science for 6.5 years and recently left because I felt like I was called to writing for children. Because I don't have copies for purchase, I'd like to make a deal with you. My book is available on Kindle for free today, so if you like what you hear and you want to hear more, you can read the book for free on Kindle today only. And I want you to, if you like the book, and you maybe want to share it with somebody, come back here to the book bar and purchase the paperbacks that will be available within the month here at the book bar. And I'll have some signed autograph copies for you. Okay. So I'd like to read to you this chapter one of Mary Andromeda and the Amazing Eye. Chapter one, The Forbidden Room. Mary Andromeda crept silently towards the top of the stairs. She peered between the narrow spindles of the railing, her eyes fixed on the room below, like a lioness stalking her captors from behind the bars of the cage. Her little sister, Cassiopeia Andromeda, followed behind. "Mary, we shouldn't do this," the younger girl whispered nervously. Mary's eyes scanned the room, the open entry hall of her uncle's mansion. "Don't worry, it'll just be a minute." She took another silent step forward, and another. "But what if we get caught? Uncle Edwin would... He won't be back until after the meeting, so you have time." Mary crawled onto the top stair. She listened. She heard the thumping of her heartbeat and her sister's breathing and the sound of an airplane outside and the ticking of the large clock in the room below. "Mary, I don't... Come on." Mary pounced down the stairs, her slender legs blurred under her flapping yellow summer dress, and her curly blonde hair bounced with each step. Her sister followed behind. After reaching the bottom stair, Mary rushed across the entry hall and slipped into a corridor, like a mouse hunted, running for its life along the cracks of the stone floor. She glanced over her shoulder, no one had seen them, and scurried along, hovering close to the wall until she reached the end of the passage and stopped in front of the door. An unusually large door, a rose-red door with a strange spiral letter A carved into the wood, the forbidden door that she had been told never to open, ever, or so said Uncle Edwin. Mary withdrew a large metal key with a similar spiral A design from her dress pocket. "Mary, I still don't think..." "Of course you don't, Cassie," Mary said sharply. "Don't be so afraid." Mary used the key into the keyhole, metal scraped against metal. The sound echoed down the hallway and throughout the house. "Shh," whispered Cassie. Mary listened. The house was silent. She turned the key. The lock clicked. "Come on, let's go. Hurry." She twisted the knob, flung the door open, brushed her little sister inside, took one last glance down the hallway and stepped forward into the forbidden room. Then, quietly closing the door behind her, she placed one ear against it and listened. They were alone. She took a deep breath and smelled books. Musty old books. She turned from the door and gazed at the scene within. The room was circular and large, at least 2 stories high, and there was paper everywhere, piles upon piles of paper, books, journals, and loose pages. Stacks of paper towered above them like the columns of a deep room, and collapsed rows of paper waist high lined the floor like the walls of a maze. Mary imagined huge paper sea monsters writhing and thrashing in a rolling paper sea, flinging and hurling paper everywhere in a violent fury, destroying some ancient and forgotten paper temple. "What happened here?" said Mary astonished. She stepped towards a collapsed pile of journals which lay near her feet. "Wow, look at that," whispered Cassie, pointing up at the ceiling. It was a sky blue dome, painted with billowing white clouds, and in the middle was a large circular window, like the pupil of an eye, through which sunlight poured in. "Why would this room be forbidden?" asked Mary, puzzled. "It's beautiful." Cassie shrugged. "Maybe Uncle Edwin doesn't want us to see how messy it is." "It's just books and journals and paper. What's the big deal?" said Mary. She pushed her glasses farther up her nose. What's the big deal? It looks like a library exploded, and then it rained books for a day, and then it all exploded again, said Cassie. There has to be something here, said Mary, something more important than messy piles of paper. She picked a journal off the floor in front of her. It was covered in dust. She wiped it off and read the title out loud. The Flora and Fauna of Evergreen Isle. She thumbed through the pages and stopped at a drawing of a tree and read the caption. The Evergreen Isle cedar is the largest species on the island, towering upwards of 30 meters with a diameter that typically exceeds 2 meters but not more than 3 meters. Mary paused and looked up at Cassie. Well, that certainly seems like a top secret, hide in a locked room, never let anyone read it sort of thing. She set the journal down and picked up another. A study of Evergreen Isle tide pools, she read and rolled her eyes. I better not even open that. Sounds dangerous. Cassie giggled. Mary liked the sound. She liked making her sister laugh. She picked up another journal, pulled her glasses down to the tip of her nose, stuck her chin up in the air, and read the title in a dignified voice. The Mathematics of Evergreen Isle Pine Cones. Cassie laughed out loud and then quickly covered her mouth. Really? The Mathematics of Pine Cones? Mary said. She picked up another journal, opened it with a flourish, cleared her throat with an aristocratic cough, and read again. This unusual pattern of rotation defies the accepted laws of gravity. Cassie laughed harder while trying to muffle the sound with her hands. And is but one of the mysterious, Mary began to gesture with her finger for emphasis. And wonderful, Cassie was laughing out loud. Qualities of the Andromeda? The laughing stopped. Cassie looked serious. Andromeda? She asked. Who's that one by? Mary closed the journal. The cover was blank. She opened it to the first page and read the inscription aloud. The Journal of Vera Andromeda. Mom's? Cassie asked. Yeah, I think so, said Mary. Mary flipped through the journal, scanning the words on one page before turning to another. Looks like it's about stars and galaxies and gravity, with lots of numbers and charts. She turned back to the first page and stared at her mother's name. I like her handwriting, said Cassie. Mary traced the letters slowly with her finger. Yeah, me too. Why would Uncle Edwin have Mom's journal in here? And why would it be forbidden? She asked, puzzled. I don't know, but maybe there's more, Cassie said. She quickly dropped to her knees, pulled a journal from the pile, and glanced inside it, and then set it down and picked up another. Mary joined her. As the minutes passed, the sunlight pierced through the window overhead, landing on the floor like the beam of a spotlight, and crawled slowly over the sea of paper, as the earth turned and the angle of light changed and the sisters searched. Mary, look, Cassie called out. Mom's sisters, the ones from the accident, she read. The Classification and Composition of Stars by Annie and Cecilia Andromeda. She flipped through the pages and then frowned and set the journal down. More stuff about space, nothing about Mom. Mary picked out an old-looking tattered journal at the bottom of the pile and opened it. The title was written in flowing cursive script. Hey, listen to this, she read. The founding documents of the Royal Fellowship Society, compiled by Caroline Andromeda. Grandma? Asked Cassie. What's the Royal Fellowship Society? Wondered Mary. She flipped through the yellow and brittle pages. A sound came from inside the house. Cassie gasped. Mary cocked her ears towards the door. They waited. Bang! The silence was broken. It was the slam of the front door. It had lingered too long. Uncle Edwin was home. Oh, no, said Cassie. She looked at Mary, eyes wide, waiting for instructions. Mary thought for a moment. We can't leave now. If he doesn't see us leaving the room, he'll see us leaving the hallway. We have to wait. Maybe he'll go upstairs or into his office, and we can sneak out. A faint sound of footsteps came from the entry hall. Uncle Edwin was pacing back and forth at the base of the staircase. Oh, no, he's pacing again, whispered Cassie. We could be here for hours. As they waited, Mary imagined a mouse trapped in a hole, patiently waiting for the slim chance to slip out unnoticed past the dangling claws of a hungry cat. But soon, the sound of the pacing stopped and was followed by the creaking of the staircase and footsteps on the second floor, which gradually moved off into a different part of the mansion. Thank goodness, said Cassie, relieved. Mary listened. The house was silent again. She stood and handed her grandmother's journal to Cassie and smoothed her dress over her legs. Bring the one for Mom and Mom's sisters. We'll go through the parlor and out the kitchen door to the treehouse. He'll think we were there the whole time. He'll never know. What about the key? Asked Cassie. What if he finds it's missing? We'll worry about that later. Come on. Mary opened the door as quietly as she could, and Cassie slipped out. Mary followed and then carefully locked the door, dropped the key into her dress pocket, and led the way back down the corridor. "Please don't catch us, please don't catch us," she thought. Before crossing the open entry hall, Mary peered around the corner up the stairs to the second floor. Uncle Edmund was nowhere in sight. Mary took a deep breath, grabbed her sister's hand, and without saying a word, ran towards the parlor, past the staircase, under the chandelier, and past the front door. Almost there, she thought. She ran through the parlor, past the couches and coffee tables. The kitchen hallway was just around the corner. "Please don't catch us, please don't catch us," she thought again. As she rounded the corner, her foot caught the rug on the parlor floor. She tripped, she tumbled forward. Cassie tumbled into her. The journal fell, the heavy metal feet flew out of Mary's pocket. She crashed into an end table. The key landed clanking on the stone floor. The vase on the end table wobbled back and forth before it fell over and shattered next to the tangled sisters. When the clangor had faded away, the house was silent. Uncle Edwin loomed over them, his arms crossed, his brow furrowed, his black eyes fixed and empty, as usual, like he was staring at something far away. "What's this?" he asked, in his calm, cold, heartless voice, as he slowly reached for the fallen journals and his key to the forbidden rooms.
JT, sit back down with anyone, have any questions for your about Buck, or being the first time, an independent author. I have a question. So, is this your first effort at middle grade writing, or how did you come up with the idea?
So many things, so many influences. One, being a science teacher for such a long time. So, how did I come up with this is my first attempt at middle grade fiction, and how did I come up with ideas? So, a couple things. One, I love that the TV series Lost, and the series of the books, the book series, I'm working on the second one now, it's called The Journals of Evergreen Isle, and they end up on this mysterious island of science. And I hope to integrate sort of science education with this group of kids, middle grade kids, sort of on an island. Can't give too much away.
Thank you. The other finalist in the juvenile literature category, Jessica Lawson, did not attend this afternoon's meeting, but I'd like to acknowledge her book, Waiting for Augusta. Our next reading today is in the young adult literature category. Reading is Ashley Coles from Beneath Wandering Stars. Can I pronounce your last name? Ashley is a high school teacher who grew up an Army brat and subsequently worked with a nonprofit that supports teens and military families. She holds graduate degrees from Duke University and the University of St. Anne's in Scotland, and teaches literature and philosophy. As a student, Ashley studied abroad in Spain and walked part of the Camino de Santiago. After her soldier brother is horribly wounded in Afghanistan, Gabriella must honor the vow she made. If anything ever happened to him, she would walk the Camino de Santiago through Spain, making a pilgrimage in his name. The worst part is that the promise stipulates that she must travel with her brother's best friend, a boy she has despised all her life. The brother is in a coma, and Gabby feels that she has no time to waste, but she is unsure. Will she hesitate too long, or will she risk her own unhappiness to keep her promise? An up-close look at the lives of the children of military families, Beneath Wandering Stars takes readers on a journey of love, danger, laughter, and friendship against all odds. All right, thank you all for being here. The scene I'm going to read today is when Gabby and Seth have just finished their first day hiking on the Camino, and they've been at each other's throats pretty much the entire way, not getting along very much.
And now they get to experience their first rite of passage on this pilgrimage route, which is surviving the nocturnal sounds and smells of a packed pilgrim hostel. After dinner, Seth and I return to the hostel, but I can't fall asleep. I'm exhausted, but snores attack me from every direction. "Easy there, Squeaky," Seth whispers from the bottom bunk when I keep thrashing around my mattress like a seal stuck in a fishing net. "Can't get comfortable." I bury my face in my lumpy pillow, but I can still smell the fragrant potpourri of human feet and hear Darth Vader breathing next door. To make matters worse, a rude latecomer decides now is the perfect time to check into the already packed joint. Naturally, this latecomer chooses the empty top bunk next to mine, the empty bed pressed right up against mine. I should have seen this coming. Do I even need to say it? The straggler is Bob from dinner. Completely inebriated, senior citizen Aussie Bob. He shakes the entire structure as he climbs onto the top bunk and does a face slant into it. The old guy is literally inches away. "Move over, Garth," because Bob produces the most guttural, "what is that, poor animal dying" snores I have ever heard. "Enough." Seth shoots out from his bed, even more distressed by Bob's imitation of a water buffalo than I am. "Come on, Gabby, get your things. We're going." "Are you crazy?" I hiss. "We can't just leave in the middle of the night." "Wanna bet?" Seth almost has his sleeping bag rolled up, so there's no use arguing. I gather my things and chase him into the dark night. The sky is an ink-spill sea filled with a million starships. There's no more sweat, no more feet. The altitude of the Pyrenees strips the air of all smells. I've forgotten what mountain skies are like, how they make you feel insignificant and infinite at the same time. "Seth, wait. What is up with you?" "Too many people," he replies softly when I catch up. "I'll never be able to sleep in that open warehouse. It's too vulnerable." I guess that makes sense. War is not how friend of the world Bobs are made. Seth heads to the entrance of the one hotel in town and returns with a single key. They only had one room left, so we'll have to share. Oh, goody. Sharing the hotel room with Seth is one more thing I can add to the list of reasons my father is going to kill me when I get home. We step into a room that smells like mold and cigarettes. Its outdated amenities aren't what concerns me. What concerns me is the one double bed. Relaxed, Seth grabs the thin outer comforter off the bed and slumps to the floor below the only window. I'm an old-fashioned gentleman, if you couldn't tell. Right, I'm sure your string of short-term girlfriends can all attest to that. I climb into the bed fully clothed and turn off the light. Are you sure sleeping on a stained carpet older than Nixon is worth the extra money? After sleeping in sand for 6 months, the floor will be just fine, so long as you aren't one of those susceptibly pretty girls who snores like an ogre. I laugh, extra loud, to cover up the fact that Seth just called me pretty and I have no idea what to do with that. As far as I know, I'm a silent sleeper, I say. Seth goes quiet, but his breathing doesn't get any heavier. The charged silence keeps his casual compliment ringing in my ears. "For your information, I've only had two girlfriends," he says finally. "So I'm flattered you think there are ladies lining up." Calling you a player wasn't meant as a compliment. Well then, neither was my ogre comparison. I snort out another laugh. "I can't believe Lucas told you that." "Told me what?" "Don't play dumb. Lucas always teases me about having giant feet for a girl my size. It's his favorite insult, so I'm practically immune to it by now." "Ah, so that's why you wear green toenail polish. In honor of your people." I shoot up in bed and hurl a pillow at Seth's head. He releases an exaggerated grunt, but I can feel him smiling in the darkness. "I really miss him," I say after a tense minute. Seth exhales. "I know, so do I." My chest tightens as I picture my brother lying in that hospital bed on life support. The ache lures me into the hazy realm of half-dreams, where childhood snapshots pass through my mind like images on a projector screen. One moment stands out. That's because most Americans remember exactly where they were on September 11th. just like most Americans a generation prior remember where they were when JFK was assassinated, or when Pearl Harbor was bombed a generation before that. I remember too. We were stationed in Alaska, and Dad, Lucas, and I had just embarked on a camping trip in the hopes of glimpsing the northern lights. But that day, something else appeared in the sky instead. The news on the radio about the planes and the crumbling buildings weren't what frightened us most. What we were most afraid of was war, because the war would change our family, change our world, change everything. Daddy's going away soon, isn't he? I'd asked Lucas. He nodded, lifting hazel eyes far too knowing for a seven-year-old. They returned to the camouflage G.I. Joe my brother carried everywhere. Heroes always have to leave the ones they love, Gabby. That's what a hero is.
Thing before we let Ashley sit back down, does anyone have any questions?
I have about the last 200 kilometers of it. So not the entire thing. The entire thing takes about 8 weeks, so I did about 2 weeks. It was wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I feel like they made this space way too small this time. Sorry, I'm going to push that banner back here. I'm sorry. Reading next is Kimberly Reed. Kimberly will read from Perfect Liars. She's the author of the Langdon Prep Young Adult Mystery Series, starting with My Own Worst Frenemy, and the Colorado Book Award winning memoir, No Place Safe. Most of Reed's family is in the crime-fighting business. Her mother was a homicide detective and her husband runs into the courtroom, so she can't help but write crime fiction, knowing she'll never run out of stories. She currently lives near Denver, Colorado, but says her roots are firmly planted on Georgia Way, in Georgia Way. Andrea Faraday is a junior class valedictorian at the exclusive Woodruff School, where she was voted most likely to do everything right, but looks can be deceiving. When her parents disappear, her life and her perfect girl charade begins to crumble. And her scheme to put things right just takes the situation from bad to so much worse. Pretty soon, she struck up the world's least likely friendship with a juvenile delinquent at Justice Academy, the last exit on the road to jail and the first stop on the way out. If she were telling it straight, friendship might not be the right word to describe their alliance. Since Drea and her new associates could not be But Drea's got a secret. She has more in common with the GB kids than they'd ever suspect.
Hi, everyone. I'm so glad to see all these book lovers here. In a case that description sounded familiar, I always have to do a disclosure where I...
This book.
The spark that of idea for this book, because it's based on a... Well, it's not based. It's inspired by... real school in the Boulder school system. And also, I think Denver PTS has a school. So my husband works at our justice center. Sometimes I go visit him, and I see all these high school kids hanging out, many of them. And so I ask him what's going on here. And it turns out our former, can you hear me okay? Okay, because I'm always forgetting that. Our former juvenile court judge started a school, and he was the co-principal, so... for kids who have been through the system. And the school was housed in our justice center. And he has since done one here in Denver. But that is where it all ends. So if any of you know about Justice High or This Is Not Your True Story, I just wanted to say that. So I thought, that is a great study for... a great study. That's my agent. I thought, what a great study for a story, if you write crime fiction, which I do. And so I needed a premise, and I came up with this idea. I wanted to play with the themes of good and bad in redemption. You know, you can make these are really smart kids who made a stupid choice and ended up in the justice system. And you can come out of that, especially when you're a kid. You're young, you can come out of that. So that's what kind of the main themes of the story. In this scene, in my fake Justice Academy, you're required to do a show and tell. to tell how you entered, what you did to go into the justice system. And in this scene, our heroine, Drea, she has been crushing on this guy who is a thief and a con artist, so she doesn't believe she's got any true story about who he really is from him because he's such a good con artist. So the judge requires them to really tell the truth about how they came here, so she's been looking forward to this. So the judge says, today's speaker has managed to avoid giving a talk for months, claiming illness, family emergencies, or finding other students into switching their scheduled dates to his, the judge explained, drawing laughter from around the room. Okay, everyone remember the rules. No interruptions and no judgment. Xavier replaced Judge Claiborne at the front of the room. Drea noticed the sheen of sweat on his forehead despite the overly air-conditioned room. The sheet of paper he was holding, freshly ripped from his spiral notebook, just before he walked up to the podium, trembled slightly in his hands. He cleared his throat several times, and for the first time since Drea had met him, he was not coolly collected. In that moment, he was no longer a masterful con artist. Drea felt his discomfort. She even felt a little bad for him. And she was really eager for him to meet. Finally, she was going to learn something true about Xavier Kwan. I was born in South Korea, came here when I was 7. They grew up on the south side of the land. Always broke because my father had an illness that made it hard for him to keep a job. So I learned how to steal. When I was 10 or 11, he got sick enough. He had to stay in the hospital for a few months. My mom died before we left Korea, so it was just me and my dad. A lot of you know how it is when you come to this country. Either you already have family here, or you join a church or community center with other immigrants, and you make yourself a new family. Not us. My father didn't like people in his business. He kept to himself. I didn't have any family in the States, blood or maid. So when my dad went to the hospital, social services fostered me out to some rich people who wanted to help the poor kid. Mostly, I just gave them something to talk about at the dinner party. But it was cool. They put me in the neighborhood school for the semester. And that's when I began stealing for a reason other than need. For the first time I can remember, I didn't need anything other than my dad to be better. I stole stuff like skateboards and bikes, things I never stole in my own neighborhood from kids like me, the ones who lived in the projects, or close enough to them that they may as well have been project kids. They never had anything worth taking anyway. Only the kids I thought deserved it. The kids who had so much they didn't even care whether they had lost something, since mom and dad would just spoil them another one, a bigger and better version of whatever I took. After a while, I ran out of customers. You can only work so many playgrounds, so many times, before people start to say, maybe this isn't really your stuff you're trying to sell. Even if your customers are kids. So I moved on to stealing things about people without even them even realizing. Wallets and watches. I worked rich people because I figured losing a few $100 wouldn't be making the rent. It wasn't like I used the money to buy games or concert tickets or stupid stuff like that. Most of it went to helping my dad with the bills. He came home from the hospital that first time, but he was on disability, and it barely covered food and rent, much less bills Medicaid didn't cover. My dad never asked me about the money. I told him I helped out at this market after school, just to make him feel good about it. And I'm sure he knew the deal. I was like 12 by then, so there's no way he believed I was working on the market, even if he was 2 weeks to leave the apartment to verify it. When he died, I went into foster care permanently. My next foster family was really rich. They had enough to pay the bills without my contribution. I kept stealing, though. And that's when I had to admit, I didn't do it for some noble cause like I've been telling myself. I stole because I liked it. I liked the thrill of not hitting the cause. Xavier stopped the story there and walked back to his seat. Drea thought he was going to talk about the arrest that would shrink him to jail, but apparently that wasn't how show and tell works. Students only shared why they took it on him, not the fact itself. That was a story Drea would have to convince Xavier to share on his own. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Any questions?
I'm hoping someone will ask her. Well, first of all, I noticed that you are reading from a handwritten notebook. Do you write anything handwritten before you write? Finish a novel?
Oh, no.
Okay.
I'm a set person. Truth is, I need to buy a book, but I can't see my little pen. So I handwrite my books, which is one of those clues I'm thinking, am I getting too old to write the kids? But I hope not. There might be a sign. But no, that's why.
Okay.
That's a better explanation.
So what about your next book?
Oh, my next book coming is called Pretty Boy Must Die. And it's the story of a CIA prodigy who It's kind of like what it, I think Die Hard meets Kingsman. I think that was a pitch for it. But anyway, he's a prodigy spy, and then he goes viral on the internet, and his cover's blown. But then he has to save his school while his cover's blown. And that would be our next screen.
You're tall like me.
Yeah, I'm not going to touch it.
So our final reader tonight is Heather Sagenfield. Heather will read from Life at the Speed of Art. Heather's fiction has won the Danahy Fiction Prize and the Arthur Edelstein Prize. It's been nominated for a Pushcart Prize and been a finalist for the Flannery O'Connor Award. She has an MFA in writing from Pacific University and lives in Vail. Silence is safe, fate is not. When Sovereign Briggs survives a car crash, she stops talking in order to seal in the memory of the final sounds of her mother's life. As conflict with her father builds and failure in school looms, Sovereign seeks relief and dangerous boyfriends and speeds adrenaline edge. Those needs collide, leading Sovereign to a snowboarding accident that changes her future and perhaps that of our universe. Life at the Speed of Us leaves dyslexia, math, cutting edge science, genius and love into a young woman's reluctant journey toward grace. She pretty much said everything I was going to say to get you ready for this. This is from the second chapter. We meet Sovereign on February 22nd, 2022. It is the first anniversary of her mother's death, after which she stopped speaking. Her boyfriend, Gage, has also broken up with her, and she has hitched her afternoon crisis. I rose from the chairlift seat and rode my snowboard away from the lift house, front boot buckled in and back boot free from the wind. I stopped as skiers and boarders streamed past. My cigarette burned warm between my fingers. I sucked a long drag of ice into the pier. White smothered everything, the pine masons, the lift house, the ground. Last night's storm moved on, and the sky was so blue, the contrast of my eyes. Don't you cry, I told myself, but I already lost the battle. Usually, this air comforted me. Up here, I felt closest to normal. Today, my problems magnified till they were like the images on a movie screen and the foam that lined my goggles with a soggy cold mass. Most afternoons, Gage and I had stood right here, buckling up after ditching sixth period. When we ditched fifth period, it was even better. I'd kiss him and stand around, daring any of their two people to report me. Even now, I felt the thrill of when one of them recognized me. I looked directly at him and take a purposeful drag on my cigarette. Most of them would look away, the dilemma of whether to tell Dad already scrawled on their faces. I remember that blank look Gage had given me an hour ago and flung my cigarette to snow. It sank beneath the surface. No doubt my rage scared off leaving him. 2:22. Failing. I was always failing. I hate tests! My voice charged out of the postcard world. I wheeled it down to the valley floor until it backed into that interstate snaking along the river into houses, restaurants, hotels, shops, and stupid schools. Idiots had stopped around me staring. I cracked my lips. Had that yell really passed through them? Disgusted with myself, I tugged on my glove, leaned over, and buckled in my rear boot. I rocked onto that foot, then my front, inching into the fall line. As gravity kicked in, I spun around in a 180, so my right leg was forward. I followed a narrow catwalk, leaning toe-side to hold the board's uphill edge. I arced onto a run called Last Chance, spraying a rooster tail of snow on a group standing around an instructor. Their cries blurred as I slashed to the run's far side and ducked beneath the yellow black striped ropes, marking the ski area boundary. This was my favorite powder stash. Gage and I poached it virtually every time we rode. We called it Shangri-La. I pictured Gage gliding along before me, brown hair ribboning against his helmet.
I smelled mom's tiny double shampoo, sobbed, and waited for Steve to build. I needed a thrill. Daily. Another source of adrenaline relieved life's pain. I accelerated to that point where panic cluttered my innards and everything, the dull peak of time, gauge, even mom, subsided beneath instinct and survival. At the edge of my vision rushed a white blur. I looked directly into a snow whirlwind just as it batted me onto my heels. When a snowboard's broad edge catches, there's no controlling its physics, and I shot into the forest. Snowy branches cracked and raked across my cheeks before I got my arms up. I veered straight at a trunk, hit it elbow first, and yelped in pain. A sound like a plucked cello string, bones breaking no doubt, vibrated through me as I fell backward into a void of snow surrounding the trunk. As I was falling into that 3 foot well, the spruce shuddered and snow, lots of it, avalanched off its branches onto me. That fall and the snow hitting me hurt like hell. I wriggled my face free, gasping, but the snow had become white cement that immobilized the rest of my body. My elbow and ribs pounded like someone was slugging me. I started to yell, "Help!" But "coward" came out. The word meant for Gage, yet when it touched air, it was for Dad. "Coward!" I yelled again. This time, for me. My toes and thin line of my snowboard weren't buried. My pigtails were stuck in the snow and tugged when I tried to move my head more than an inch. Itchy blood dribbled down my face. I laughed at the irony of my homeless protection. A crow landed in a neighboring tree, loosed a squawk, and lurched in flight. The sound of its wing beats stretched across the emptiness. I was trapped, out of bounds, with no chance of anyone hearing me, even if I screamed. I'd only whimpered once in my life, during the accident that killed Mom. I whimpered now. All I could do was stare up through that tree. I rocked my hip a little I could to the rhythm of 2-22, 2-22, 2-22, and the branches of the sky became a green, brown, turquoise, and white kaleidoscope. After a while, I noticed I was humming Blackbird, the Beatles tune Mom sang to me when I was little, and to herself as I got older. I spied a brown-gray lump of the wrong texture, a porcupine staring down. He shifted on his branch. "Yes." "Don't like my music?" I croaked. He fumbled to a closer branch and peered straight down at me. Company, at least. This weird thing happened. Maybe cold plus pain equals hallucination. All I know is that the porcupine's pelt transformed to Dad's new crew cut, and its beady eyes became Dad's. He shifted on his branch, and I saw his fear. "Dad," I said, "don't be scared. I won't hurt you." Like he understood, he started coming down, not graceful at all, claws scraping, crawling from branch to branch. I sighed in relief. Dad was finally here. He reached the last branch directly above my face, and I smelled him. My gaze focused hard, and he was no longer Dad. Willed up, that porcupine was coming down. I screamed. The porcupine tree scrabbled around and fell. He landed next to my face, loosing a grunt of pain and sending a white wave across me as quills pierced my cheek and one side of my nose. A stretched wail erupted from me and hung in the air. My second loud sound. It felt like a taunt. The porcupine's quills, the one not in my face, flapped gently as it waddled away. Then it was just me and pain and landscape. Sleeping is rude. I heard Mom humming Blackbird, Paul McCartney harmonizing now. I relaxed, mind reaching for her again. My future would end with my past. "There's a track," a guy shouted. "It went straight to that tree. Look, I knew that was a dream." Damn, it sounded like Wash. Figures, I thought, of all my possible rescuers, it was Wash. Relief and guilt pressed down on me harder than the snow. I pretended to be unconscious and pictured the two ski patrollers as we glided up and snapped up their skis. There was radio static, a post-holing step, the swish of red vortex. Wash leaned over the tree well. "Briggs, it's Sovereign. Are those quills off? What happened?" "Come on, Dad," I thought, and pretended to struggle for consciousness so I could see his reaction through my lashes. but he just hovered behind Wash, pumped with a mustache, a heart sliced open, and no clue what to do. I shut my eyes as Wash radioed to Princeton.
Thank you, Heather. And actually, I think this is actually a good time to bring everybody up, all of our readers, and just give the audience one last chance to ask everybody a question. Whether you want to ask about the writing process in general or something specific. And this is also a good chance to take a picture.
I have a question. Can I ask a question too?
Yeah.
Oh, I was wondering, what was your inspiration for walking the Camino?
Studying in Spain was the main reason. I studied medieval history, so took a class where we got to go visit parts of the Camino and just decided I wanted to walk it, yeah. So did it a few years ago, and the story, Beneath Wandering Stars, kind of came to me as I was walking. So, yeah. Can I get you all to look over here, too?
Thank you very much. Perfect, thank you. I have one question. Were all of you writers in your youth, or is it something you came to as adults?
I was not. No, it's something I'm new to in the last year and a half.
I was a writer, yeah. I've been writing not very well. writing and learning and writing and learning and writing, and I'm still writing and learning. Yeah.
Yes, I still have things I wrote when I was 8. I'm also a pack rat. But I started with poetry as a kid. It was bad poetry, but that's what I like.
Also, yes, I never thought about that I would be a writer, but I loved writing, and I think a real turning point for me was I was living overseas, and I was close to my grandmother, and I knew she'd never been overseas and was never, and I felt like my eyes were needed to be her eyes, and that was wonderful, wonderful practice. Yeah.
And I was a big reader, but didn't discover writing until much later.
Thanks. Well, thank you all so much for coming tonight and
this afternoon.
I think that kind of wraps up, but I just want to remind everyone. Ask the author the question one-on-one if you'd like. Their books are here. Of course, JT has that cool Kindle thing going on. Want to remind you guys, or let you all know, that we're going to be naming the winners on May 21st at our celebration at the Parker Art and Culture and Events Center. And you actually can attend that as well. It's a $20 ticket. And you can buy those at colorcommunities.org. So thank you all for coming, and thank you all for coming.